This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guest today is Todd Hillhouse. He has a doctorate in psychology and is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He directs the Pain and Addiction Neuropharmacology Lab, and the lab is looking into some really important research into safer drugs for pain, new antidepressant drugs, treatments for cocaine addiction, and the long-term health effects of electronic cigarettes. And we'd like to hear from you as we go about our discussion with Todd today. Join in with your questions and comments by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Todd, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Before we start talking about the research that you're doing, why don't you tell us a little bit about how a lab on a university campus actually works?
Okay. So I run the Pain and Addiction Neuropharmacology Lab. And so my expertise is in behavioral pharmacology with a focus on drug development for addiction, depression, and pain disorders. At UW Green Bay, we're somewhat unique when compared to Madison because our lab is primarily staffed by undergraduate students. So currently, I have 8 undergraduate students working in my lab. And so they usually will have 2 to 3 shifts per week for about 3 to 4 hours in the lab. And so as what we do is we train them, and as they become sufficient with all the different training, we'll start to give them different projects. And so many times students will have their own project. Sometimes they'll share a project with someone depending on the scope of the project. But overall, a lot of our projects are tied together in one way, shape, or form. Again, they're going to focus on addiction, depression, or pain. And so I usually sit down with each student and ask them, you know, what are you most interested in? What is it that you want to work on? Because I don't want to put the students in a position where if they don't want to work on the pain project, they don't have to work on the pain project. And then my main goal with having the students work in the lab, besides producing scientific literature, is to help the students reach whatever career goal they have. And so many of my students want to go to graduate school, or they may want to go to medical school. So as they work in my lab over a year or two, we work on different aspects to help them achieve those goals. So we usually have weekly meetings or biweekly meetings. We talk about the research, but I also try to help mentor them into how to make them the best candidate for med school or graduate school. And that can be working on their writing, teaching them how to network, what they should be looking for in a school. And so those are the types of things that my students experience. And then it's been hard with coronavirus, but normally I would take my students to conferences where they can network and they can also disseminate their research. So right now we're really focused on writing up our research and publishing it in academic journals, since most conferences have either been canceled or moved completely virtually. Which has been difficult in its own right.
Yeah, we can all relate to that, I'm sure. That's a great opportunity for undergraduates. Why is your lab set up that way?
I actually came from an undergraduate lab. So I am originally from California. I ended up moving to the UP up in Marquette, Michigan, and going to Northern Michigan University. I had a great mentor named Adam Pruce, who's now the chair of the department there. And that's how he ran his lab, primarily focused on undergraduates. When I went to Virginia Commonwealth University to work on my PhD, it was primarily staffed by undergraduates. We had, I think there were 3 graduate students, and we probably had 10 or 12 undergraduates. So I was familiar working with them. And once I took a postdoc at University of Michigan, I realized that being in the lab is something I want to do, but I also want to mentor students and work with students. And I look at this as an opportunity to help them learn, life skills as well as research skills. And so I think it's the best way to do it at a university like this is to focus on the undergrads, focus on the development, because if I show interest in them and their development, they really put in the work in the lab and they become very interested and they want to see the lab develop as well.
Wonderful. Now, how do you decide on the research topics that your lab will be looking at?
Yeah, that's that's an interesting one. And that's probably why I have four different areas. So I've picked up a little bit in every university I've been at. So I've worked on depression pretty much since being at Northern Michigan University. So I've done that for 12 years now. So that's always been an interest. When I got to Virginia Commonwealth University, that's when I got a little more interested in the addiction and the pain research. And so we did a little bit there. I actually worked in two labs as a graduate student. So I would work in the day at my lab in the psychology department. I'd hop on a bus, go downtown, and work in the pharmacology department in the medical school on the addiction and the pain projects. And I just became fascinated with them because there's so much that we don't know yet. And so when I picked my postdoc, I ended up going to a lab that focused on addiction and pain, not as much depression. So I learned more skills in that area, and I just find these three areas so interesting that I can't seem to let one go. And I do let the students kind of drive the project, and that's where I picked up the electronic cigarette research, is because my former students were really interested in knowing more about electronic cigarettes. And I said, sure, you know, my skills translate to that area, so why don't we go ahead and start working on that project as well?
So then where does the funding come from to do these projects?
Currently, a lot of it has been with startup money. So coming to the university, they give you some funds to start your research projects. And so we've been able to use that money mostly. We also, it's an animal lab. It's a mouse lab. So we breed our own animals, which significantly reduces the cost and allows it to happen here at a university of our size.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently just awarded a UW Regent Scholar Grant, which is a very competitive grant. And so that will fund a lot of the cocaine and antidepressant research that we will be doing. And then the goal will be to use some of the data that we collect over the next year and submit a National Institutes of Health grant to fund the research for the foreseeable future.
Okay. And then who gets to see the results of your research? Who gets to use it?
Anyone. So we do publish our results in academic journals, and so they are out there. There are sometimes you have to pay for an article. If anyone were to contact me directly, I can send them a copy of the article. So that's the best way we disseminate, is through these published research or at conferences. And so, again, if anyone is listening and they have interest in certain articles, I'm happy to share them. And this goes for anybody. So if you are interested or you're looking up scientific research and you find an article that you want but the publisher's charging $35 for it, contact one of the authors and they will send you the paper for free. We're allowed to do that.
Yeah, good to know. So let's start talking about some of your projects now. And let's talk about the safer drugs for pain management part of it. And opioids, of course, have been the drug of choice, basically, for a really long time. How do these drugs actually work to stop pain? Let's begin with that.
Okay. Yeah, so opioid drugs are effective for treating pain. They're much more effective for treating acute pain than long-term pain. But when you take an opioid drug, it's going to be distributed throughout your body. And so there's three main areas where this can act. Two are good and one is not so good. So the first one is in the periphery of the body. It can act at the site of the injury. So if you have a knee injury, when you take something like morphine, it can activate the opioid receptors in your knee, which will help dampen or eliminate that pain signal from reaching your brain. If the pain signal doesn't reach your brain, then you don't process that pain. So that's a good site for that. The second one is in the preoctal gray area, or the PAG of the brain. And we believe that's really important for the pain signal. And essentially the pain signal is blocked from being sent to the other sensory areas of the brain. And therefore you don't experience as much pain because of that. The last place opioid drugs will work is in the nucleus accumbens of the brain, which is the reward center. And this is where we see the addiction side of opioids. So we don't want it to act in that area, but we haven't really designed a way to not activate these receptors until now.
So is that what you're doing then in your lab, is activating how to stop those from being activated?
Yeah, so we recently published a paper in collaboration with a group at University of Michigan where I did my postdoc, and they designed drugs that are called allosteric positive modulators, or positive allosteric modulators. So these work in a totally different way than regular opioids. And so we have what's called an opioid receptor. And on that opioid receptor, there are binding sites where neurotransmitters that your brain produces or your body produces can bind to. If something binds there, it's called the orthosteric site. Basically, that's where your body wants to be activated, is in that specific site. Drugs like fentanyl and morphine will bind to that site and activate the receptor. Another way about going about this is to activate what's called the allosteric site. That's anywhere else on the receptor that's not the orthosteric site. So you're binding to a spot on the receptor and not the same place where a neurotransmitter or your body would normally activate it. One of the benefits of these is that a lot of the times, or at least the drugs that we discovered, these positive allosteric modulators don't activate the receptor on their own, which is different from opioids. So if you're not in pain and we give you one of these positive modulators, you're not really going to feel anything at all. However, if you hurt your knee, your body is going to release endogenous opioids to help you with that pain. So what our drug does is you take it and it will enhance your endogenous opioids. So if you have pain in your knee and now your body's releasing these opioids, our positive modulators will help enhance their effect to be more effective. But the best part is that they will go to the nucleus accumbens, but since you're not releasing opioids in the nucleus accumbens, you're not going to have that rewarding or that abuse liability or the addiction liability.
Okay. So these results, have you been seeing, you're impressed by what you're seeing? Is this something that's going to be going to the next step in research? Is it going to the manufacturers of drugs, or where are you in the research at this point?
Yeah, so we did a proof of concept study, which was published in the Proceedings of PNAS, which is a very nice, prestigious journal. And so, if someone would like that, I'm happy to share that. And so what we were able to show was that it worked in various pain states in a number of different assays in acute pain and chronic pain, which was very promising. We found that when given itself, it really didn't do anything unless we increased the endogenous opioid system. So the proof of concept worked in relieving the pain state. We did some follow-up studies where we wanted to see, did it produce addiction? And we did not see it produce addiction in animals. We actually also saw that it did not produce constipation. The main side effect of opioids is producing constipation. So that's a good sign showing that it's not activating the gut opioids and that it is being selective for the pain site. And then the last thing we did was we checked it on respiratory depression. That's the main reason that people will overdose from prescription opioids, is that they might take one too many pills and it causes respiratory depression. And what we found in mice was that this did not produce respiratory depression. So we had a very nice proof of concept study that was very positive. So now what we're trying to do is discover more of these positive modulators. I know there's a couple other groups around the world that are starting to look at this to find the best possible combination, because we want to make sure that it can enhance. And these positive modulators can enhance to different degrees. So you can have one that barely enhances the normal endogenous system, and then you have some that will greatly enhance it. So right now, I think we're still in the drug discovery phase. We have the proof of concept, but now we need to find, a handful of really, really promising drugs that we think produce the greatest effect and then move forward with those.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Todd Hillhouse, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Lots of great, amazing information, but of course, there's a lot of information. Do you have questions about how this all works? We'd like to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. Mackenzie Crummy is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. After 11:45, we'll talk about the positive effects of exercise for those that are going through and recovering from cancer treatments. And right now we are talking to Todd Hillhouse, who is the director of the Pain and Addiction Neuropharmacology Lab at University of Green Bay. And we were just talking about one of the research areas that you've been doing, which is safer drugs for pain management, but you also do deal with new antidepressant drugs. So why don't you tell us about that work, Todd?
Yeah, this is a passion I've had since I started graduate school. And so we know that about 15% of the population suffers from depression at one point during their lifetime. Unfortunately, traditional antidepressants that we have only work in about 50% of patients, and there's a 4 to 12 week delay to have remission be achieved. And so for somebody who is struggling with depression, that's not, both of those aren't very promising. So we've always been looking for a novel treatment that can produce rapid antidepressant effects. Ketamine, which is used in children as an anesthetic and in veterinary medicine, was recently found back in 2000 to produce rapid antidepressant effects within about an hour. And these will, after one injection, these were sustained for about a week, which was very, very interesting. And so a lot of research has gone into understanding how ketamine works, because other drugs that are similar to ketamine haven't worked in the clinic in the same way. And so what my lab has been doing the past 5 years is trying to figure out what is different about ketamine compared to drugs that are similar to ketamine. And so we have undergrads that are working on this project now, and we recently published a paper that found that the opioid system is involved or required for the antidepressant effects of ketamine, which was not previously known. And so this gives us some target for future drug development.
And for those, there's been a lot written about ketamine and some of the psychedelic drugs, I should say. And ketamine, maybe people have heard as Special K, which is used like as a street drug name. So you might have heard about that. What are your thoughts? They sound so promising when you read these articles. What do you think about it? Are they as promising as they sound?
I think there's a lot of information that still needs to be collected. I think that there is promise. I think the biggest issue we're having with developing these drugs is that ketamine and the other drugs that are interested, the other psychedelic drugs, are DMT, which is the main active ingredient in ayahuasca, psilocybin, which is the main active ingredient in magic mushrooms, and then LSD. All of these have shown promise in animal or clinical studies as being an antidepressant. The major issue we have is that all of these drugs produce hallucinations or subjective effects. So this creates a major issue where now the subject or the patient knows they got the drug. And so because they know they got their drug, a demand characteristic is put on them. And so now they think, oh, I got the drug, I should feel better. So it makes it hard to know if we're seeing kind of a placebo effect where they say, I got the drug, I should feel better, so I feel better. And so there's some confusion on whether or not that's a true antidepressant effect or if it's more of this demand characteristic. So there's a lot of research going on right now to figure out, can we produce antidepressant effects without producing hallucinations? Is there a way for us to basically give these drugs in these micro doses where you don't have a subjective effect? And would they still produce antidepressant effects? And unfortunately, in terms of the clinical data goes, we don't have enough yet. And one of the main reasons we don't have enough data yet is that the psychedelics, LSD, DMT, and magic mushrooms are all Schedule I drugs by the DEA, which makes it extremely hard for research labs to use them, especially when it comes to clinical research. It's really hard to go to the governing boards and say, I would like to give these people LSD or these Schedule I drugs, because according to the DEA, Schedule I drugs have no medical benefit and they are highly addictive. So a lot of the times the governing bodies say, well, we don't want you to give participants a highly addictive drug. And so we're slowly getting more and more data. But this is one of the major roadblocks that we're running into at this point in the research.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones. We have a couple of people who have questions and comments for you. If you have one, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can always send an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. So let's go to Mike in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What's your comment or question?
Okay. my comment is, well, what he was just saying about Schedule I drugs is really good. But there's a man who was an opiate addict for 40 years, and he was one of the four founding physicians of Johns Hopkins, and he could do marvelous work. Today he's called the father of modern surgery. Today anybody in his situation would be locked up in jail. And people that sold those drugs on the street are thrown in jail. But doctors who prescribe them is one-fifth of the new heroin addicts. And I appreciate what he's doing to help, but what everybody else is doing is not.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Did you have any response for that, Todd?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Martha in Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Yes, this is an interesting discussion. I want to make sure I'm taking away the right things. The research that your guest is doing then would make derivations, whatever the word is, of these drugs less addictive. Am I right in that? And also people would be less dependent. Could your guest talk about the difference between dependency and addiction and address the stigma of legitimate pain, you know, needs for these drugs? And then also my last request is, has your guest taken these drugs to an extent that physically he would understand, you know, what an opioid patient might go through? That's my question. Thank you.
Todd?
Oh, those are great questions. I think there are a couple in there. So the drugs we're developing, these positive allosteric modulators, are not derivatives of currently used opioids. They're a completely different class of drug. And so in being a different class of drug, they bind to a different site on the receptor. And they, according to our research, our preliminary research that we published, they seem to be less addictive than the current opioids. I personally have not taken opioids, so I do not know exactly how they feel. These ones, because they're in a proof of concept study, they're not approved for human use, so no human has taken them. I mean, it's all been done in animal research. And yes, there is a big stigma with addiction, and I think that does need to change to some extent. Rather than, as the first caller mentioned, putting them in jail and locking them up, we need to come up with better ways of treating it and making it so that it's, you know, the general public doesn't put them in a very negative light, and that they say, okay, how can we help this person come out of this addiction? What are our different options? And so there is some thought that maybe these compounds might be able to be used for addiction, but that's not necessarily what we've tested yet.
Okay, great. Thank you, Martha. Appreciate that call. Let's go on to Bill in Muscadet. Hi, Bill. What's your question?
Well, my comment actually is about microdosing. I obviously live in Wisconsin, so I can't say too much, but I know of someone who has regularly been doing a microdosing of psilocybin mushrooms, and it does seem to improve like just overall mental happiness, I guess, and clarity over weeks and months of using it. And I noticed no addiction, and the person that takes it notices no addiction. So, like, something you can just stop on a dime. So the whole addiction thing is really weird to me, that people say that, you know, like LSD, psilocybin, things like that are actually addictive, when I've never seen any actual physical, like, evidence of that. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Is he, can he stay on the line?
Bill, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Todd.
Bill, do you know, and then I will comment on this, do you know if you're the person that is microdosing, are they feeling the effects of the drug?
No.
When they take it, do they feel like they get high?
No, because initially they, you know, would start out with a certain amount, let's say like 2 grams in a little capsule. You just powderize it and put it in those empty gel caps, like the 1 gram ones. And they started with a higher amount, let's say like 2 or 3 grams, and they did feel the effect. And then they just slowly dosed down until they didn't, and then kept it that rate, which is around 1 gram, I believe.
Okay. Perfect. So that's where I was going with this. So I'm actually working with a group of other researchers, some from overseas and some from here, where there's a big issue with the term microdosing. And so it sounds like the person you're mentioning is microdosing. So microdosing should be where you take the drug, but you don't feel the effects. You don't feel like you get high.
Like the euphoric effects. And yep.
And but the problem is that most of our clinical research that's been published, there are doses that also produce hallucinations. So that's where I was saying we need more research, because many of the published studies aren't using microdosing. They're using full dosing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an important distinction, is making sure that we're actually, we use the term microdosing very loosely right now. And I think it's because it makes it more socially acceptable for the general public. But we're using it, generally using it incorrectly. And then to talk about the addiction of these drugs, I think a lot of scientists agree that drugs like ketamine and these LSD mushrooms, a lot of those probably will not be heavily abused. Ketamine is, there is a percent of the population that uses ketamine, but it's very, very low. And then if you do talk to people who use LSD or some of these psychedelics, many have don't want to go home and do it every day, or at least they don't want to get high on it every day, because there is a come down, and that does have a negative effect on the person, and it doesn't feel great.
Okay, great. Thanks for that call, Bill. Much appreciated. You know, one of the other things that you talked about earlier is the UW Regents Scholar Grant for studying addiction, and you're focusing in on cocaine addiction, I believe. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that research?
Yeah, so what we know about cocaine addiction is that it is significantly higher in patients with some type of mental illness, and we don't have any really good treatments right now. Many times the treatment is something very similar to cocaine. So you're taking them off of cocaine and trying to give them something that maybe is more controlled. But the goal would be to get them completely off of the cocaine or the cocaine-like drugs. And so we recently published some literature that, or study that showed that the opioid system is a viable target. And I know I just told you, and we just talked about how opioids are bad and they're addictive. But it's important to note that there are four different types of opioid receptors. Drugs like morphine and fentanyl, the ones that are highly abused, those activate the mu opioid receptor. I want to stay completely away from that. So I'm not targeting that receptor. I would focus on something like the kappa receptor and the nociceptin receptor. The kappa receptor works on the stress part of addiction. When we have something stressful, we will release dynorphin, which activates kappa receptors. And then the nociceptin receptor, we believe, plays a role in some of the learning and memory associated with addiction. So by targeting these two receptors, we can safely target the opioid system. And if we just, as long as we don't target the mu opioid receptor, we shouldn't have the abuse liability.
So talk a little bit more about the learning part of it. Why you say that that plays an important role in addiction. What do you mean by learning, and what is that role?
Yeah, so if somebody takes a drug, they generally are going to take the drug in the same type of environment. And so what we end up starting to do is produce these through Pavlovian conditioning, the different types of learning. Different, the environment will play a role in different types of cues. And so now when that person goes to a specific house or goes to a specific location, their body will actually prepare them for drug taking because it sees different stimuli that they've now associated or learned. Okay, when I see that, whether it be a water bong or a needle, their body will now react and say, okay, I'm going to get ready to take drugs. And so that's the environment, that's the learning, the environmental part of addiction. And that's actually the hardest part of addiction to overcome. Many times to be successful in recovery, people have to move away from where they did drugs. If you stay in the same environment where you did the drugs, you're going to have all of these different cues that are going to remind you, and your body's going to react. And now you have this craving to take the drug. And so there's some thought that maybe this nociceptin receptor might help us disrupt that learning and disengage it. And that's what this grant is going to help us evaluate.
Okay, so if you you go to you go out with a specific person to a specific place, you have this learned reaction, but these specific drugs that you're talking about may help you break that addiction so that if you do go with that person to that place, you may no longer feel that need. Is that what you're saying?
We think that's how it's working.
Okay.
And that's what this grant is going to hopefully allow us to determine.
Okay. Great. I know we're kind of wrapping up things here, getting towards the end of our time, but you had mentioned earlier that your students had wanted to start studying e-cigarettes, and there have been some really disturbing statistics that have been recently released about the use of e-cigarettes by middle and high school students. So why don't you share some of those statistics with us?
Yeah, what we're finding is about... I think we're right around 30% of high school students are using e-cigarettes, and about 15 to 20% of middle school students are using e-cigarettes. And that's very concerning because of their age. Their brain is not fully developed, and so this is going to lead to likely long-term changes. A lot of the times we actually see, too, that as these people get older, they start to switch over to cigarettes. And which has its own issues. And so our lab is currently looking at what the effects of adolescent e-cigarette use, how that will change them in the long term. So will they become more susceptible to addiction in adulthood? And will it be just nicotine addiction? Will it be other addictions, behavioral addictions, cocaine addiction? And we also want to know, how does it affect health? We have some preliminary data to suggest that it might actually have detrimental effects on mood disorders. It might cause things like anxiety and depression in adulthood. And so there's not a lot of research on it. What makes e-cigarettes different is how we're administering it. So we also don't know how the vapor, inhaling the vapor, how that might magnify the effects of nicotine, or how we actually published a paper where we showed that just the vapor itself without nicotine had detrimental effects on mood disorder. So there's a lot going on with these e-cigarettes that we don't currently know, and there's a lot of people using them, thinking that they're safe when they're not safe.
And where you get this information from? Are you actually using, is it clinical or is it animal, or what kind of research are you using to get this info?
Yeah, a lot of the statistics I'm giving you are from the CDC.
Okay.
And then also I did collect some data from a population of about 500 students, and we got very similar data. And then my lab has actually published both on clinical data, where we actually had people smoking or had people vaping and did some of that with clinical, and we've done some studies in animals. So with this e-cigarette, it kind of morphed, and we went into both the clinical and the preclinical or animal aspects, and we're seeing some translation between the two different models.
Okay. So, I'm thinking about all this research you're doing and how long it takes to, start with this idea, do so much research and, get it to the right people. And you must be the people that you work with must be extremely patient. Is that something that you need to be a researcher?
Yes. It does take a long time. Experiments fail or they don't follow our hypotheses. And so, I try to, when I work with my students, explain that to them so that they don't get discouraged. And that's one thing where I do have a large lab, usually 8 to 10 students. And so we each, like I said, we sometimes will share a project. And so each person might be working on a different aspect of the project, which just allows us to finish it faster. If only one person did it, it might take us 2 years. But if we do it as a group, we might be able to get it done in about 6 months.
Yeah, and that's actually a short period of time if you think about how long sometimes research takes, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We did get an email I want to get in real quick before we leave. It's Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, emailed and wants to know if nicotine activates the same reward center in the brain that opioids do, and could there be a way to block the reward center to help people stop smoking?
Yes. And yes, the answer is yes. it does it through a different mechanism, but what ends up happening is all of these drugs of abuse, cocaine, opioids, nicotine, even behavioral things like gambling, pornography, all of these increase the dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. So that increase in dopamine is what causes those rewarding effects. We can't just block dopamine, because if we do that, dopamine is very important for movement. So if you block dopamine, it's going to have other side effects that are really unwanted. And so that's why with some of these studies, we're trying to find different ways of targeting each addiction. So it's possible that, very similar to the cocaine study, it's very possible that the opioid system that I've been working on might work for nicotine addiction. We just haven't got there quite yet to test it out.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Todd. We really appreciate you taking time away from your research to tell us about it. And hopefully you can come back and give us some updates later on to see how things are going.
That would be my pleasure.
Okay, great. We've been talking with Todd Milhouse. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back to talk about using exercise as part of a treatment plan for cancer.